Liquid Books, Budapest's weekly English language cultural magazine.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Liquid Books. We are joined this week by a very special guest. Good evening.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mr. Arthur Dahl, you are involved with the environment, and if I understand rightly, you have worked in the capacity as Deputy Assistant Director for the United Nations Environment Programme, is that correct?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that work?
Well, I was deputy head of one of the major divisions of the United Nations Environment Programme, dealing with the monitoring and assessment of the global environment and giving early warning of problems that are coming. So one of my functions there was to help to implement the decisions taken at the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 in Agenda 21 on providing information for decision makers. And so we were setting up global monitoring assessment programs to collect data on what was happening to the world's environment, identify new problems that were coming so that we could sort of warn governments that they need to prepare for these problems.
Since then, you've also added a tremendous amount of work to your profile, as I understand it, with working with coral reefs and with island ecologies.
Well, coral reefs are an original scientific specialty. I'm a coral reef ecologist by training. So my original research was on these complex systems and what they need in order to live, how they work. I then spent more than a decade in the South Pacific Islands, where I was the regional ecological advisor to all the Pacific Island countries and helped them organize a regional environmental program. So it was not just the problems of their coral reefs, but all of their island environments, and helping those governments and their peoples to find ways to develop sustainably in harmony with their environment.
One fruit of your many years of study in these areas is a principle which you call the eco-principle. Can you tell us a little about this?
Well, it's from a book that I wrote at the time of the Rio Earth Summit, when I knew I was going to be responsible for helping the United Nations to develop indicators of sustainable development, how to measure the world's progress, countries' progress towards greater sustainability and solving its environmental problems. And so I wanted to sort of think through in my own mind what science told me about the environment, where the system was going, what my own spiritual beliefs told me about what the world was doing, where it was going, and to integrate these into ideas that I could then put in practice in my work with the United Nations. And so the concept of the eco-principle was basically a simple way of looking at, you might say, systems science, systems thinking, as it applied to both natural systems and human systems, and particularly as it bridged the approaches of ecology and the approaches of economics, because ecology is the study of the environment of our house, of where we live, and economics, from the roots of the word, is the management of our house, of where we live. So the two need to be complementary.
Both of these words, as you've pointed out, derive from the same Greek root.
Yeah, the same Greek root, eco. And that's why the eco-principle was that sort of the principle in systems thinking that united those two domains that too often had been separated, even antagonistic, when they needed to see their complementarity and learn to work together.
So then you are suggesting a way of managing our house, the environment, through economics, using models which are more natural, more sustainable. Is that right?
Yes, I think the economic system as we've developed it in the Western world has been very focused on creating material wealth. And that is an essential function of any society. Every society must generate wealth, must have wealth. But at the same time, by taking a sort of a narrow materialistic view of development only as creating wealth, it has ignored many other dimensions to development that are equally important for us in terms, say, of our social development, our development in the natural environment. And because of its narrow view, for instance, it has traditionally seen the environment not as natural capital to be managed wisely, but as free resources for the taking to be developed and used. And this is one of the things that has pushed us towards unsustainability, towards destroying the resource base of the planet. So bringing some thinking from, you might, system science and the natural sciences into the economic perspective is one way to helping to reestablish that balance, to show new directions in economics that help us to become more sustainable.
I've heard of a couple of initiatives in recent years along these lines. One is to revise the formulas for lending on the world level to include the value of natural resources and the cost of replacing them, and another more recent initiative, these eco credits for pollution credits that countries can save and trade. Are these examples of what you're talking about?
Yes, I mean, you know, the World Bank, as part of its rethinking of its work with respect to sustainability, has explored not only, might say, economic capital, but social or human capital and environmental capital as a broader way of looking at, you know, different resources and how one might consider sustainability at a national level, for instance. Is a country properly managing its natural capital so it will keep producing the natural resources it needs long into the future? And therefore to take these criteria into account, for instance, in financing of projects. So there have been a number of efforts. There have also been a whole set of, you might say, side accounts developed by the United Nations Statistical Office to the national accounts that are used for calculating things like GDP and other economic statistics, but also trying to identify environmental statistics that could be used in complement to give countries a broader picture of where they're going. So there have been a number of tools all taking steps in that direction. Unfortunately, there are many things that we can't measure in economic terms. I mean, how do you calculate the value of a human life? Or what is the value of, you know, a natural area full of endangered species? If it's not sold or marketed, the economics has no way of giving it a value. It may try to estimate values in some way, but they are always rather shaky. I mean, and when, for instance, there were attempts to estimate the value of human life, and when they showed that a human life was worth much more in an industrialized country than in a poor developing country, this raises moral issues. Is it really just that you weigh people differently because, you know, they cost more to educate or they live at a higher standard of living? So this is why one cannot ignore an ethical or moral dimension in all of these questions, as well as looking at the scientific approach or the economic approach. And that's one of the challenges of thinking for sustainability, is to bring together all these dimensions.
Is there a straightforward step-by-step way to incorporate ethics and responsibility into the current economic system, or is what you're suggesting a transformation based on values that we now have as we come to understand better the environment and our relation to it?
Well, I think we have to distinguish the mechanisms of the economic system, like the market mechanism, for instance, which, you know, have demonstrated their worth and are, you know, certainly presumably essential parts of any future system. Every attempt to try and centrally plan prices, you know, has not worked, whereas the market has been able to find an efficient way of calculating prices. But when the market mechanism is interpreted in the sense of the values of, you might say, 19th century Darwinism, when economics as a science was first developed, you know, Adam Smith's invisible hand of self-interest, for instance, or sort of the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest, and therefore you could drive your competitors to the wall and you win out in the competitive game of economics. When you bring those values in, it often brings distortions into the market system, attempts to manipulate it that get away from even the pure economic concept of a market as based on perfect information. So It's not the market mechanisms that are the problem. It is the values underlying many of the conceptions of economics and the economic system as it operates today in the world, which, because they are either based, say, on national self-interest, building your economy and winning out over other economies, or winning over your competitors, when in fact, so even with a market mechanism, it might be more effective as a mechanism if there were a more open, consultative, sharing way of deciding on prices, rather than trying to manipulate the truth to get the comparative advantage over the enemy. One might say, sort of say, what is the appropriate just price between your costs, my needs, and so on? There's no reason why different values could not operate with the same economic mechanisms, but make them more effective and more just at the world level. And problems of justice are one of the serious problems with economics as a practice today, because the present economic system has been driving the world towards extremes of wealth and poverty. It's the inherent nature of the system is a concentration of wealth. Those who have wealth, get more power and therefore can get more wealth, which is why even the most free enterprise countries like the United States of America have to legislate against trusts, against domination in the market, in order to ensure a true competitive market and prevent the extremes from taking place. So this is where values and ethics have to find their place, you might say, at the economic table, to rethink elements of the economic system as we try to go from a system that has not worked very well, that has failed in many ways, for instance, in developing Africa and many parts of the world, to one that may better respond to the needs of humanity.
Even in your description just now, you're conflating or collating an economic model and ecological model when you describe the current system as Darwinian. Mm-hmm. Now, you yourself have been responsible for some of the same islands that Darwin first visited in developing these principles. How has our understanding evolved since he first formulated these principles, and what have you found in your own observation that supports this transformative system that you're describing?
Well, of course, the great genius of Darwin was to recognize that ecological systems were dynamic, were constantly changing, that there was a process of evolution taking place, including a process of progression, that animals and plants were not fixed entities, but were constantly changing entities. And this is a concept that also applies to society, to civilizations. We have seen civilizations evolving and developing, rising and falling, just as species evolve, develop, rise and fall. So Darwin's genius was to apply, in a scientific sense, this concept of evolution in the natural system. But what we see as we look more closely, even at the natural systems, is that the mechanisms that operate as you achieve higher levels of evolution, sort of big, more perfected systems, more advanced systems, they go from the kind of 19th century image of the survival of the fittest, of the struggle for existence, which brings the wolf devouring the deer and all sorts of bloodthirsty images, which is the way things were seen in the oversimplified way at the beginning, that the more highly evolved systems like coral reefs that I've worked on, the principles of cooperation, of collaboration, of symbiosis, working together, become more and more dominant in the system. And there are those that eat and are eaten, but it's part of an important set of balances that maintain the dynamics of the whole system. And you find many other examples of cooperation, and some of which are almost unbelievably fantastic, the way fish cooperate together and work with each other.
Can you give us an example from a coral reef system?
Well, there's an example. There's a small fish that's often called a cleaner fish. And it's a brightly colored fish, which I think would be dangerous on a reef to be brightly colored and attractive, something that would come and eat you. But in fact, they feed on the parasites that attack larger fish. And so you see these big predatory fish coming up to a cleaner fish and opening their mouths so that the cleaner fish can swim inside and pick the parasites off its teeth and clean its gills. And the big fish is looking very happy to get these itchy things taken off of it. And it doesn't bite on or eat this little fish because it's receiving a service. And therefore, it allows the fish to perform the service. The same thing is true of, say, the clownfish and the sea anemone. The people who've seen the film Nemo have suddenly, this is, you know, everybody has suddenly learned about clownfish. But here you have another brightly colored fish that lives with a large fish-eating animal, the anemone, that paralyzes and devours fish. And the little clownfish swims back and forth, attracting big fish. When they come to try to eat it, it goes and hides in the anemone. And the big fish can't stop in time and is paralyzed and eaten. And the clownfish gets the table scraps. So the clownfish receives protection and food, and the anemone gets food. Each one helps the other. And there are many other examples like this, of which is much more closer to the kind of collaboration, cooperation that we see in human society than the traditional concept of the struggle for survival in biology. These are the kinds of new perspectives we also need to bring into the economic system, that the competitive approach of always sort of destroying the competitor produces enormous wastage in terms of wasted capital, wasted trained labor, and so on. Whereas if we look in a more collaborative way, how do we fulfill all of the potential in our society to create wealth? We may approach some of these questions very differently.
We'll take a short break and come back and speak further with Arthur Dahl. Thank you. We're back talking with Arthur Dahl. Tell us a little more about your concept of the eco. What is an eco?
Well, I took that term to refer to, a simple abstract entity that defines a functioning element of a system. It could be, for instance, in an organism, each cell in the organism is an individual functional unit. It could be a corporation as a whole, a business entity. It could be a nation. It could be any of many different things that one would want to understand how that system worked. And the advantage of giving it this conceptual framework is that you can then say, what is really important about the working of that system? And particularly, how does its information content, how is it controlled? How does it communicate with what's outside of the world, outside of it? And how does one relate the way the system works inside to the way it interrelates with other parts, larger levels of a system?
So an eco can be a physical system, a biological system, or an economic system, a cultural system, a political system.
Yes. It's much a convenient abstraction to ask some basic questions about how any system works. And what I found in my comparison of these various kinds of system was that, in fact, it didn't take very much information from outside to control most systems. Most systems function largely sort of within themselves. And an organism as a system, it works very well. But for instance, we as human beings, our bodies function more or less autonomously and independently. We do take in food, we release waste products, we have to breathe, so there's certain flows in and out to keep the system operating. We also take in information. We learn, we listen to things, we have ideas, we express ourselves through talking. So again, the information is flowing in and out, and that allows us to function in larger systems. In the same way, you know, a corporation takes in certain raw materials and then, you know, sells, you know, generates certain products that it exports, may produce certain wastes. It has certain intellectual capital in terms of, say, the patents that it owns, the processes that it uses. It has management that listens to what's going on, what is the potential in the market outside, takes decisions, and, you know, drives that corporation to respond to the needs in the market. This kind of an abstraction helps to focus on what is really essential about making any of these systems operate, and particularly in terms of their sustainability, how you might want to make certain those systems survive into the future.
Are there specific reasons, conditions, or developments in the world nowadays to explain the perceived imbalance of economic systems and business activities?
Well, when we make this kind of a systems analysis, we recognize that, in fact, we have many different nested levels of systems. In the same way that the human body is made up of many individual cells, each of which is its own functioning eco, those cells are made up then into tissues and organs and then into the whole body. In the same way, our human society goes from individual human beings to communities, to regions, nation states, and then the whole world. So we need to understand how we're functioning at all these levels. And as we evolve, we get systems organized at higher and higher levels, both geographically and conceptually. And one of the great challenges we face in the world today is that we're just in the process of making a transition from, you might say, a social world made up of nation states, of functioning nation systems that evolved in the 18th, 19th, early 20th centuries, and now to a global world system, a single planetary system, which has been created by the evolution of science and technology, which has eliminated all of the barriers to the complete flow of information around human beings around the world. But we haven't yet built the systems management mechanisms to manage that global system, which is why we see the imbalances in the world today between very rich and very poor countries. We see the facility with which, say, multinational corporations can go everywhere and make money without necessarily any respect for social rights or, you know, other values we may think are important, because there's no legislation globally to control their operation. So many of our problems are there because we are just in the process of evolving a new level of systems operation without having the mechanisms to manage that system to the human being's advantage.
So then it's an evolution of the notion of a system to a functioning, coherent global system. That's the transition which we're seeing today.
Yes, we have become a single system, you might say, scientifically, physically. You can pick up a cell phone and call just about anywhere in the world and talk to almost anyone who has a cell phone. You can get on an airplane and in 24 hours you can be anywhere on this planet. You turn on, you know, the evening news and you see immediately a disaster is taking place somewhere else. So you might say, intellectually, you know, socially in a certain sense, we've become united into a single world system. But we have not yet, for instance, developed any kind of system of governance at the world level to manage those problems that we're creating at the world level, like the problems, the environmental problems of climate change and damage to this sort of like ozone layer and loss of biodiversity. We're doing all sorts of things to this planet as a whole without having the instruments in place to control or manage or resolve those problems or those situations.
So it's a political question. It's an economic question. To what extent do you also perceive it as a question of values or ethics? Is there something missing from that picture still for us?
Well, I think in many ways, and this is something that I think comes from the analysis of the eco-system, the eco-principle, is that since information is what really controls the operation of systems, what's really the real richness, what defines a system, much more than any material components which can be constantly changing, at the level of human society, our values, the principles we operate by, the basic principles, are what really determine how our society is structured, how it relates to other parts of society. You know, if you have learned to love all humanity, you relate to different kinds of human beings very differently than if you've learned to love your nation and consider everybody else as the enemy, for instance. And therefore, if we need to evolve towards a more united world system, we also need to transform the values that we operate under to values that are compatible with the needs and challenges of functioning at a world level. And this is, I think, also important, looked at, say, as a biologist. When I look at, say, biological systems, the information is captured in the genetic code. It's the genes that determine the instinctive behavior of organisms, what they eat, you know, how they function, how they reproduce, how they relate to other organisms in their environment. But for human beings, it is our values that determine, you know, how we do many of the things that we do in society. And therefore, in the same way that for a species to evolve, you need changes in its genes, mutations in its genes that may open up a new potential for evolution. So in the same way, if we want to evolve, we need mutations, transformations in our values that will open us up to adapt and evolve and develop at this new level, this new global level.
Is that something that we can take responsibility for and achieve proactively? I mean, are there any models out there or any indications that that is the process we're going through?
Well, I think if we look at the historical progression of civilization, of society, there have been periods of transformation of values at different times in history, often related to changes in the scale of the functioning of society. Whether, for instance, if we go back to, say, the time of Moses, of Jewish times, there were a number of the scattered tribes of Israel. And through the values that Moses brought, which were the concept of law, obedience to law, even if it was an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, the Ten Commandments, certain basic laws for the functioning of society, those principles, those values, allowed the creation of a great Jewish civilization, a flowering of civilization that even flowed over and influenced, ancient Greece and so on and so forth. Socrates was clearly influenced by the thinking of the Jewish people in his own philosophical thought. So, and in the same way, Christ came at a time when there was a very strong material empire, the Roman Empire, but in which the values were lacking. The people, enjoyed themselves watching naked ladies being devoured by lions on Sunday afternoon in the Colosseum. It's a bit like some of our, more brutal sports today, but still. So he brought a set of complementary concepts, spiritual concepts or values, turning the other cheek, loving your enemy, things that were a necessary complement to what existed for civilization to again take the great step forward that Christianity brought in the evolution of the world. And even Muhammad brought concepts of submission to the will of God, to the will of the whole, a spirit of working together that went beyond what, say, Christ had taught, that laid many of the values that are the foundation of the modern nation. The first universities were Muslim. Many of the institutions we associate with the modern nation find their roots in those creative values that Muhammad brought. And so, today we're at a similar sort of point of transition in history where we need to consciously adopt a set of values, say, what are the values that will help us take the next step in our evolution towards a world society where we can function in our diversity but live, in this diversity in a united world.
Let's picture a healthy, functioning world of the near future. What are some of those values which become universal in such a world? What is the shared core of values that we need to manage this transition effectively?
Well, certainly one of the most fundamental is justice, because you can never get any kind of cooperation between people without justice. You know, if I go up to you and I say, you know, you must make this sacrifice and I'm going to get all the benefit, will you cooperate with me? But if we sit down together and say, well, we each have to make some sacrifices, we will share the effort, and you will both get a benefit in some just and equitable way, then there's a basis for cooperation. So if we're going to address these problems of the world, the peoples of the world will only be willing to cooperate together in solving those problems if they see that there is a just, transparent process taking place, that the efforts are being borne in some shared way, and the benefits also are, you know, shared, that everyone can benefit from the progress that is made. So justice is, in many ways, you might say, the cornerstone of that kind of evolution towards, you know, in terms of human collaboration. But there are other principles as well. I think to recognize that we are all members of the same human race, and that in the same way that a human body, if the left leg is broken, the right arm can't say, I'm fine, thank you, it doesn't worry me. You know, if part of the body is suffering, the whole body suffers. And in the same way, and this is something that's now coming with communications technologies, with the internet and the news media, we immediately see suffering everywhere in the world. We see it's human beings like ourselves. So we are acquiring that sense of solidarity. We saw it with the tsunami, you know, in the Indian Ocean, when the whole world responded to a catastrophe in one area. So this is growing, it is developing. And that sense of solidarity, that sense of responsibility, is another of the key values that will help us to overcome all those divisions that have, you know, forced us apart, that have produced, you know, the violence and chaos and warfare and the other things that have been so divisive in the world up until now. I think we will, as that feeling, that awareness grows, the concept of aggression and violence will become less and less acceptable to the majority of humanity, and we will then be willing to create the institutions, the structures, the mechanisms that will be able to prevent that from taking place. Another value that I think is critically important from the point of view of sustainability is moderation. Because you can do many things to a moderate level and they're not harmful. You push them to an extreme and they become extremely damaging. You take a little bit of a medicine and it's just what you need to cure you. You take the whole bottle and it kills you. And it's the same way, I mean, pollution, a small amount of pollution can be absorbed and purified by the environment. Too much overloads natural systems and they break down. And in the same way, a certain amount of material civilization will be compatible with the limits of this planet. Too much is pushing it beyond those limits and causing those systems to break down with climate change and other kinds of global destruction. So if we want to achieve a sustainable world society, one that will last, you know, for generations into the future and continue to meet the needs of our children and their children and many generations to come, then we need to say, how do we apply the values and principles of moderation to what we do at a material level? How do we change our concept of growth in economic sense from material growth, with material things, always acquiring more and more things, to growth in those other dimensions of human civilization and society that do not need to respect limits, like beauty? We could always have more beauty. We'll never run out of beauty. You know, art, culture, there are many aspects that need to keep developing. You know, science and knowledge. We can steer ourselves more and more to grow in those directions while learning to maintain a more moderate balance in terms of the way we live our footprints on this planet and the damage we're doing to the planet.
Take a short break and continue.
Thank you. succeeded day, and day had succeeded night, and the hours and moments of your lives have come and gone, and yet none of you hath for one instant consented to detach himself from that which perishes. Bestir yourselves that the brief moments that are still yours may not be dissipated and lost.
Talking with Arthur Dahl. Tell us a little more about some lessons that you've learned from your experience in the tropics.
Well, one of the beautiful things in the tropics is that the natural systems have had a chance to evolve for a very long time and perfect themselves. Tropical rainforests, coral reefs, and so on. Whereas temperate areas, I mean, Europe went through ice ages where it was covered by ice, and then the forest grew back again, and it was covered by ice, and so on. Nature in this part of the world is relatively, you know, young. It's only recently regenerated to a certain extent. Whereas if you look at a coral reef, you can find fossil coral reefs 20 million years old and recognize some of the same species that you see on reefs today. So clearly these are systems that have a chance to perfect themselves, improve themselves, find the perfect balance. And so when I look, say, at a coral reef, and I say, well, here is a system that is functioning in a very resource-poor environment. The beautiful tropical waters you see in tourist posters, you know, the transparent water in the white sandy beach, the blue lagoon, it's so transparent because it's empty. It's a biological desert. There's nothing in it. It's, you know, you look at the waters of the North Sea or, you know, the Baltic or something like that, and they're sort of green and soupy because they're full of algae. They're very biologically rich. So a coral reef is a very rich, productive system, like a city very much, in an extremely resource-poor environment. And we're going to face exactly the same kinds of challenges in human society. We have more and more people trying to live on this planet with higher and higher density, and we don't have many resources. So I say, how does the reef work that allows it to function in that way? And one, it's very efficient at capturing renewable energy, solar energy. The reason you have all these fantastic shapes on the reef, all these branched shapes and forms, is because it's creating surface to absorb more sunlight. In the same way the trees in a forest produce many leaves to capture as much sunlight as they can. And so, you know, the systems are designed to sort of maximize the capture of renewable energy. Then they recycle the materials very efficiently within the system. There's very little waste on a reef. You know, we have a tendency in our society to use something once and throw it away. Nothing gets thrown away on a reef. There's always something there ready to eat it and use it. And your scarce resources like phosphates, you know, are carefully recycled within the system. So that they're not lost because they're hard to get. And so you see many little animals that are trying to capture bits of plankton coming by, and when they get it, then that's recycled inside, even to the extent that many of the animals on the reef actually have plants living inside of them. It'd be like having cows in a field that were green and just sat there in the sun making them who didn't have to eat grass. It's the same kind of thing. But the coral animals themselves have algae living in them. And so the waste products of the coral animals go directly to fertilize the algae in their own tissues. And the algae release food that directly feeds the corals. So they have a kind of a closed system right inside the animals. And many other animals as well on the reef, the giant clams, are the same way. They sort of sit there in the sun making their own food because they have algae living inside their tissues. So in a sense, evolution has allowed the reef to develop these highly efficient systems for capturing, you know, resources that are available, renewable resources, recycling them to be able to build up high population densities, high richness and productivity. These are the lessons that we need for human society. It's not a society that can just, you know, pumps oil out of the ground, consumes it, you know, throws away the pollution, and says it's living well. But a society that must learn to use the renewable energy that will always be there, and that we can use to provide the needs of our society, our civilization, and at the same time, ways in which that system can absorb our waste. I mean, I can imagine a future where we live in beautiful urban forests. We don't just have, you know, concrete, you know, roads and buildings and the sterile surface, but we will be able to, you know, evolve ecosystems of which we are a part, full of beauty, you know, agreeable places to be, but at the same time that will generate the raw materials we need for our society in terms of energy and materials to make all the things we make, that will absorb our wastes in some natural way. We will again become part of these systems and live in harmony with them. So I think, you know, the future is biological if we don't destroy it all in the meantime. We need the genetic resources of the planet, all the wonderful richness created by these wild places that we have in tropical rainforests and coral reefs. They will give us the raw materials to evolve this new and exciting civilization if we don't destroy it first. Unfortunately, today, with our unsustainability, you know, we're raping the Amazon rainforest. This last year, they had the highest rate of loss, like in about 10 years. You know, thousands and thousands, millions of hectares are being destroyed. And, you know, the coral reefs are collapsing from the stresses that are coming from climate change, from overfishing, from pollution. So we're rapidly destroying the very models that might help us to show us how to live in the future.
What are some concrete obstacles which exist in today's world which prevent us from evolving efficiently in that direction?
Well, I think perhaps the most fundamental is that we don't yet have widespread acceptance of the values that we need to build this coming world society. I mean, particularly acceptance of the oneness of humanity, that we are all part of the same family. There's still too many people attached to their particularity, their cultural group, their national group. You know, that is their priority and everything else is secondary. It's not that these loyalties are wrong, but that they need to be put in perspective. It's wonderful to love your country if you also love the whole world. And you see your country as a part of the richest contribution to that world. But if your national patriotism takes priority, my country first, and I couldn't care what happens to anybody else, then this becomes very destructive to our attempts to address these problems, you know, at a world level. So the problem of values is part of the problem. Another critical issue that we have to face is the very short-term perspectives of most decision-making. A corporate manager is under the pressure of his quarterly balance sheet and, you know, his annual report. You know, the investors are looking to see, you know, is the growth there that they were expecting and so on. And if they don't see it, even on the short term, it's, you know, off with his head, find somebody else. A politician never looks beyond the next election. Their concern is to be reelected. And, you know, there are very, very few statesmen in the world who really have a long-term vision beyond their own, you know, term in office. And yet many of the environmental problems of sustainability, are problems that are running over decades. You look at even something like, say, the damage to the ozone layer from the chemicals that we've manufactured, the chlorofluorocarbons. And other problems. You know, we've used these things in spray bombs or in, you know, transformers, and it takes 15 years for them to work their way up to the stratosphere and cause their damage. So the damage that we see today was caused by our actions 15 years ago. And the control measures we're now putting in place will only begin to show their effects, you know, in the decades to come. It may take 70 years at the best of conditions to restore, you know, the ozone layer to pristine purity. So we're looking at, and climate change is a much longer term process even than that. So we're looking at things that are happening over decades, if not centuries. And we just don't have decision-making frameworks adapted to those levels of needs, to those challenges. So that's another critical dimension that we have to face, a critical barrier, is to begin to be able to think long-term as well as short-term, and take a much more integrated and holistic view of where we're going on the planet.
You have brought up the notion of the great ages of world religions as progressive contributions to this story. Many would take a more pessimistic view and identify them as the problem. And for all of the great benefits that you've identified, such as the development of universities and so on, we may also see some of the greatest destruction in their name or associated with them. Likewise, too, many people may not perceive that we have gone anywhere, and that the kind of progression that you're describing is realistic. So I ask, what mechanisms are there for us to address these obstacles and these problems? How can we move forward?
Well, I think if you first look at the religious dimension, yes, certainly religion has become an excuse for all kinds of abuse of power, domination, violence, and you know, all the religions have been guilty in one way or another of these things down through history. But I think that we have to separate the initial impulse in a religion, which brings a creative new set of values, and what man has done with that impulse over time, as he's built power structures around it, and the clergy that, you know, have their own self-interest in perpetuating it, and human interpretations that are added on to, you know, the initial purity, you know, of the values that were brought in that religion. Therefore, just as with a biological organism, it goes through a period of birth and growth and youth and development and reaches maturity and bears fruit or produces offspring, and then it ages and declines and finally, you know, is no longer functional and dies. And this same process, cyclical process, is true of all human institutions. Religions have, you know, their springtime, their youth, their maturity, their fruit-giving time, and their old age and their decline, which is precisely why we find through history that they are renewed periodically, because no one religion seems to meet human needs forever and ever. So there's a process of renewal of religion that is part of that same evolutionary framework that Darwin illustrated so well in his understanding of biological systems. Religion also goes through an evolutionary progression. And therefore, I think I'm a member of the Baha'i faith, and I see that this as another step in the evolutionary progression, trying to address, you know, the problems of the world, at a global level, renewing and updating our spiritual values and concepts, not denying the past, appreciating what the past has brought, but renewing it and adapting it to the challenges and needs of the present time. The same thing is true at the political level. All sorts of horrible things are done in the name of politics. Doesn't necessarily mean that political institutions are inherently bad. We need political structures. But whether they operate through a kind of competition for power, a struggle for power, or whether they can be reconceived in a more constructive way as, you know, instruments of governance where we can, you know, collectively govern ourselves in some more participative way, And there are many models around the world, there are alternative ways of doing things. We sometimes are locked in a particular conceptual framework that we must do things this way. And then you suddenly find, but there are exceptions. I mean, you know, just take something as simple as having an army. You know, how can you have a nation without an army and armed forces? You know, most people think that it's one of the symbols of national sovereignty to have armed forces. And yet Costa Rica has not had an army since 1949. You know, they got sick and tired of military coup d'etat, and they just abolished the army. And they've done very well, you know, ever since. And I was there for an international conference, and we met. We had the opening session in the Opera House with the president and the ministers. And then we walked down the street to the conference facility to continue the conference. The only security I saw was some Boy Scouts at the corners to stop the traffic while we walked by. Now, here is a country with no army, and the president feels that he can stroll down the middle of the capital without, you know, people, you know, with guns all around him to protect him. This shows that it's possible. I mean, this is in a region that's had all sorts of wars going on around it and so on. So I think we need to sort of be a little more creative as to what is possible, whether it be in religion. Religion doesn't, because it has, you know, been the source of many evils in the world, doesn't mean that it is inherently wrong or isn't necessary. And politics, even though it's also been the source of many evils, you know, I think everybody would agree we still need to have some kind of systems of governance in order to address our common problems. So I think we need to be a little detached from those historical dimensions, say, how can we draw the best of each of these dimensions as we try to find a way towards the future?
Are there signs that this dialogue is happening at a global level in a healthy way?
Yes, so I think there are very constructive things, and we're still far from being perfect. In the United Nations, where I've worked for many years, you can see progress. You see governments accepting more and more the need to collaborate, and the environment has been one of the forces helping governments to come together. I was involved at an early stage in what UNEP's Regional Seas programs, and one of their programs in the Mediterranean, since the early 1970s, has had, you know, Israel and Libya working together, Greece and Turkey working together. You know, when it came to the environmental problems, they could ignore, you know, the political problems they had at other levels. We had a program in the Persian, you know, Arabian Gulf, and it would be intergovernmental meetings between Iran and Iraq, while they could hear the bombs of their war on the other side of the Gulf. So the environment has been one of the forces that help governments to come together and to work together. So there is an evolution in mentalities, a gradual acceptance of the need to collaborate and to find common solutions at a political level. In the same way, there's been a growing ecumenical movement among the religions. I took part in 1995 in a World Summit on Religions and Conservation. In Windsor Castle, Prince Philip was the host, and there was the Ecumenical Patriarch from Constantinople for the Orthodox Church, and there was the Pope's Special Advisor on the Environment, Archbishop of Canterbury, you know, the Vice President of the World Jewish Association, the World Council of Churches, the leading Baha'i dignitary, you know, the one of the 14 highest Hindu swamis from India, the head of Mongolian Buddhism, and the Vice President of the Taoist Association of China. Now, they all came together for 4 days of debate, and they all agreed. You know, I was there for the United Nations presenting issues to these religious leaders, and they sort of said, in the area of the environment, sustainable development, our responsibility to the planet, the values of all religions are the same. We all believe in a sense of responsibility, of stewardship, of concern of future generations. You know, there was a commonality there. And I think in more and more, you know, this is coming to the surface in various areas. You know, as a Baha'i, I was asked to serve on a working group of the Catholic Church in France to prepare a declaration for the bishops on the environment. So there is, you know, there is a steady opening place, you know, at the political level, at the religious level, and certainly in civil society. The NGO community is becoming more and more united, and the internet is one of the things that's helping to create these new links, this new sharing, this new opening around the world. So these things are very, very encouraging. And even though we can be depressed by the problems that we see of rising terrorism and so on, the very shaky nature of our present civilization and our concerns about its future, there are all these constructive things taking place that will allow us to say, yes, we can develop alternative models. Yes, there are examples out there of new ways of doing things. They're working at a pilot scale. If we build on those and strengthen them, we have hope for the future.
Thank you so much for talking with us. You are really bringing us some vital news of great import. and helping us to open our eyes to the fact that we are living through really an emerging paradigm in the world of tremendous value, and that we can really choose our paradigm, and we can live in this new world that you're describing, and that it is real, that it's existing in your
part of it. And it brings together the domain of science, always run in the accomplishments of science, and the domain of religion, all of the done in advancing in values, and by those two complementary forms of knowledge coming together, they can give us the foundation to move ahead towards a new society.
I hope you will come up back and join us again, and for all of us here at Liquid Books, for our engineer Naji and for myself, thank you for coming and speaking with us.
Thank you, it's a great pleasure. I'd love to come back again. Thank you.
Good night.
Plenty money and dress like a millionaire.